to a new category of impulsive disorders on a spectrum alongside ailments like Tourette syndrome. He thinks this is wrong. In all my decades of clinical work, he says, OCD patients are always anxious. They worry about their obsessions. I mentioned that at a conference I'd attended a few weeks earlier, one of the rationales given for why OCD might be reclassified as something other than an anxiety disorder was that its genetics and its neurocircuitry seemed to be substantially different from that of the other anxiety disorders. "Goddamned biomedical psychiatry," he blurts. Dr. W. is ordinarily a gentle, even-keeled guy, and he is aggressively ecumenical in his approach to psychotherapy. He has tried in his writing and in his clinical practice to assimilate the best of all the different therapeutic modes into what he calls an integrative approach to healing the wounded self. He is also, I should say here, the best therapist ever. But he believes strongly that over the last several decades, the claims of the biomedical model generally, and of neuroscience particularly, have become increasingly arrogant and reductionist, pushing other avenues of research inquiry to the margins and distorting the practice of psychotherapy. Some of the more hardcore neuroscientists and psychopharmacologists, he feels, would boil all mental processes down to their smallest molecular components without any sense of the existential dimensions of human suffering or of the meaning of anxious or depressive symptoms. At conferences on anxiety, he laments, symposia on drugs and neurochemistry, many of them sponsored by pharmaceutical companies, have started to crowd out everything else. I tell Dr. W. I'm on the verge of abandoning the project. "I told you I was a failure," I say. "Look," he says, "that's your anxiety talking. It makes you excessively anxious about, among other things, finding the correct definition of anxiety. And it makes you worry relentlessly about outcomes, about whether my definition of anxiety will be wrong. Instead of concentrating on the work itself, you need to focus your attention. Stay on task." "But I still don't know what basic definition of anxiety to use," I say. "Use mine," he says. No one who has ever been tormented by prolonged bouts of anxiety doubts its power to paralyze action, promote flight, eviscerate pleasure, and skew thinking toward the catastrophic. None would deny how terribly painful the experience of anxiety can be. The experience of chronic or intense anxiety is above all else a profound and perplexing confrontation with pain. Barry E. Wolf, Understanding and Treating Anxiety Disorders, 2005. As it happens, I had chosen Dr. W. as a therapist a few years earlier, precisely because I found his conception of anxiety interesting, and his approach to treatment less rigid or ideological than previous therapists I'd worked with. Also, I thought the author photo on his book jacket made him look kindly. I discovered Dr. W.'s work when, while in Miami attending an academic conference on anxiety, I stumbled across a book he had recently published on a display table outside a hotel ballroom. Though the book, A Guide to Treating Anxiety Disorders, was geared toward professional psychotherapists, his integrative conception of anxiety appealed to me. Also, after reading so many specialized books on the neuroscience of anxiety that featured sentences like, "Theta activity is a rhythmic burst firing pattern of neurons in the hippocampus and related structures, which, because it is synchronous across very large numbers of cells, often gives rise to a high-voltage quasi-sinusoidal electrographic slow theta rhythm, approximately 5 to 10 hertz in the unanesthetized rat, that can be recorded from the hippocampal formation under a variety of behavioral conditions." I found his writing to be clear and non-technical, and his approach to his patients refreshingly humanistic. I recognized my own issues, the panic attacks, the dependency problems, the sublimated fear of death masked as anxiety about more trivial things in many of the case studies in his book. I had recently moved from Boston to Washington, D.C., and found myself for the first time in a quarter century without a regular psychotherapist. So when I read in Dr. W.'s author's note that he had a practice in the Washington area, I emailed him to ask if he was accepting new patients. Dr. W. has not cured me of my anxiety, but he continues to insist that he will, and in my more hopeful moments, I even sort of think he might. In the meantime, he has provided me with useful tools for trying to manage it, good and steady practical advice, and perhaps most important, a usable definition, or a taxonomy of definitions, of anxiety. According to Dr. W., the competing theories of and treatment approaches to anxiety can be grouped into four basic categories: the psychoanalytic, the behavioral and cognitive behavioral, the biomedical, and the experiential. This schematic overview of the different theoretical approaches to anxiety is necessarily somewhat oversimplified. The psychoanalytic approach, crucial aspects of which, though Freudianism has been widely repudiated in most scientific circles, still permeate modern talk therapy, holds that the repression of taboo thoughts and ideas, often of a sexual nature, or of inner psychic conflicts, leads to anxiety. Treatment involves bringing these repressed conflicts into conscious awareness and addressing them through psychodynamic psychotherapy and the pursuit of insight. Behaviorists believe, like John Watson did, that anxiety is a conditioned fear response. Anxiety disorders arise when we learn, often through unconscious conditioning, to fear objectively non-threatening things, or to fear mildly threatening things too intensely. Treatment involves correcting faulty thinking through various combinations of exposure therapy, exposing yourself to the fear and acclimating to it so your fear response diminishes, and cognitive restructuring, changing your thinking in order to extinguish phobias and to decatastrophize panic attacks and obsessional worrying. Many studies are now finding that cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is the safest and most effective treatment for many forms of depression and anxiety disorders. The biomedical approach, where research has exploded over the last 60 years, has focused on the biological mechanisms of anxiety, on brain structures like the amygdala, hippocampus, locus coeruleus, anterior cingulate, and insula, and on neurotransmitters like serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, glutamate, gamma-aminobutyric acid, GABA, and neuropeptide Y, NPY, and on the genetics that underlie that biology. Treatment often involves the use of medication. Finally, what Dr. W. calls the experiential approach to anxiety disorders takes a more existential perspective, considering things like panic attacks and obsessional worrying to be coping mechanisms produced by the psyche in response to threats to its integrity or to self-esteem. The experiential approach, like the psychoanalytic, places great weight on the content and meaning of anxiety, rather than on the mechanisms of anxiety, which is where the biomedical and behavioral approaches concentrate, believing these can be clues to unlocking hidden psychic traumas or convictions about the worthlessness of one's existence. Treatment tends to involve guided relaxation to reduce anxiety symptoms and helping the patient to burrow into the anxieties to address the existential issues that lie beneath them. The conflicts between these different perspectives and between the psychiatrists, MDs, and the psychologists, PhDs, between the drug proponents and the drug critics, between the cognitive behaviorists and the psychoanalysts, between Freudians and Jungians, between the molecular neuroscientists and the holistic therapists, can sometimes be bitter. The stakes are high. The future stability of large professional infrastructures rides on one theory or another predominating. And the fundamental conflict, whether anxiety is a medical disease or a spiritual problem, a problem of the body or a problem of the mind, is age-old, dating back to the clashes between Hippocrates and Plato and their followers. Modern science has eventually shown Hippocrates to be the more correct. The mind does arise from the physical brain and, in fact, from the whole body. But Plato's influence on the study of psychology has nevertheless remained powerful and enduring, in part because of his influence on Freud. In the Phaedrus, Plato describes the soul as a team of two horses and a charioteer. One horse is powerful but obedient, the other is violent and ill-behaved, and the charioteer must wrestle mightily to make them work together to move ahead. This view of the human psyche as divided into three parts, the spiritual, the libidinal, and the rational, presages the Freudian mind with its id, ego, and superego. For Plato, even more than for Freud, successful psychological adjustment depended on the rational soul, logisticon, keeping the libidinal soul, epithymeticon, in check. This passage from Plato's Republic uncannily prefigures Freud's Oedipus complex. All our desires are aroused when the rational parts of our soul, all our civilized and controlling thoughts, are asleep. Then the wild animal in us rises up, perhaps encouraged by alcohol, and pushes away our rational thoughts. In such states, men will do anything, will dream of sleeping with their mothers and murdering people. When Wilfred Trotter, an influential British neurosurgeon of the early 20th century, came across this passage, he declared, "This remark of Plato makes Freud respectable." But while in many places these competing theoretical perspectives conflict with one another, they are not mutually exclusive. Often they overlap. Cutting-edge cognitive behavioral therapy borrows from the biomedical model, using pharmacology to enhance exposure therapy. Studies show that a drug called D-cycloserine, which was originally developed as an antibiotic, causes new memories to be more powerfully consolidated in the hippocampus and the amygdala, augmenting the potency of exposure to extinguish phobias by intensifying the power of the new, non-fearful associations to override the fearful ones. The biomedical view, for its part, increasingly recognizes the power of things like meditation and traditional talk therapy to render concrete structural changes in brain physiology that are every bit as real as the changes wrought by pills or electroshock therapy. A study published by researchers at Massachusetts General Hospital in 2011 found that subjects who practiced meditation for an average of just 27 minutes a day over a period of 8 weeks produced visible changes in brain structure. Meditation led to decreased density of the amygdala, a physical change that was correlated with subjects' self-reported stress levels. As their amygdalae got less dense, the subjects felt less stressed. Other studies have found that Buddhist monks who are especially good at meditating show much greater activity in their frontal cortices and much less in their amygdalae than normal people. The very best meditators seem even to be able to suppress their startle response, a rudimentary physiological reaction to loud noises or other sudden stimuli that is mediated through the amygdala. The strength of one startle response, whether measured in infancy or adulthood, has been shown to be highly correlated with the propensity to develop anxiety disorders and depression. Meditation and deep breathing exercises work for similar reasons as psychiatric medications do, exerting their effects not just on some abstract concept of mind, but concretely on our bodies, on the somatic correlates of our feelings. Recent research has shown that even old-fashioned talk therapy can have tangible physical effects on the shape of our brains. Perhaps Kierkegaard was wrong to say that the man who has learned to be in anxiety has learned the most important or the most existentially meaningful thing. Perhaps the man has only learned the right techniques for controlling his hyperactive amygdala. For his part, William James, like Darwin, believed that purely physical, instinctive processes preceded awareness of an emotion, and in fact preceded the existence of a given brain state. In the 1890s, he and Carl Lange, a Danish physician, proposed that emotions were produced by automatic physical reactions in the body rather than the other way around. According to what became known as the James Lang theory, visceral changes generated by the autonomic nervous system, operating beneath the level of our conscious awareness, lead to such effects as changes in heart rate, respiration, adrenaline secretion, and dilation of the blood vessels to the skeletal muscles. Those purely physical effects occur first, and then it is only our subsequent interpretation of those effects that produces emotions like joy or anxiety. A fearful or angering situation produces a series of physiological reactions in the body. And then it is only the conscious mind's becoming aware of those reactions and appraising and interpreting them that produces anxiety or anger. According to James Lang, no purely cognitive or psychological experience of anything like anxiety can be divorced from the autonomic changes in the viscera. The physical changes come first, then the emotion. This suggests that anxiety is primarily a physical phenomenon and only secondarily a psychological one. My theory, James wrote, is that the bodily changes follow directly the perception of the exciting fact, and that our feeling of the same changes as they occur is the emotion. Common sense says we lose our fortune, are sorry and weep. We meet a bear, are frightened and run. We are insulted by a rival, are angry, and strike. The hypothesis here to be defended says that this order of sequence is incorrect, and that the more rational statement is that we feel sorry because we cry, angry because we strike, afraid because we tremble. Physical states create psychic ones, and not vice versa. The James Lang theory was later undermined by research on patients with spinal cord injuries that prevented them from receiving any somatic information from their viscera, people who literally could not feel muscle tension or stomach discomfort, people who were, in effect, brains without bodies, yet who still reported experiencing the unpleasant psychological sensations of dread or anxiety. This suggested that the James Lang theory was, if not wholly wrong, at least incomplete. If patients unable to receive information about the state of their bodies can still experience anxiety, then maybe anxiety is primarily a mental state, one that doesn't require input from the rest of the body. But various studies conducted since the early 1960s suggest that the James Lang theory was not, after all, completely wrong. When researchers at Columbia gave study subjects an injection of adrenaline, the heart rate and breathing rate of all the subjects increased, and they all experienced an intensification of emotion. But the researchers could manipulate what emotion the subjects felt by changing the context. Those subjects given reason to feel positive emotions felt happy, while those given reason to feel negative emotions felt angry or anxious. And in every case, they felt the respective emotion, whatever it happened to be, more powerfully than those subjects who'd been given a placebo injection. The injection of adrenaline increased the intensity of emotion, but it did not determine what emotion that would be. The experimental context supplied that. This suggests that the autonomic systems of the body supply the mechanics of the emotion, but the mind's interpretation of the outside environment supplies the valence. Other recent research suggests that James and Lang were right in observing that physiological processes in the body are crucial to driving emotions and determining their intensity. For instance, a growing number of studies show that facial expressions can produce, rather than just reflect, the emotions associated with them. Smile, and you will be happy. Tremble, as James said, and you will be afraid. Darwin observed that the equipment that produces panic anxiety in humans derives from the same evolutionary roots as the fight-or-flight reaction of a rat or the aversive maneuvering of a marine snail, which means that anxiety, for all the philosophizing and psychologizing we've attached to it, may be an irreducibly biological phenomenon that is not so different in humans than in animals. What, if anything, do we lose when our anxiety is reduced to the stuff of its physiological components, to deficiencies in serotonin and dopamine, or to an excess of activity in the amygdala and basal ganglia? The theologian Paul Tillich, writing in 1944, suggested that angst was the natural reaction of man to fear of death, conscience, guilt, despair, daily life, etc. For Tillich, the crucial question of life was, are we safe in some deity's care, or are we trudging along pointlessly toward death in a cold, mechanical, and indifferent universe? Is finding serenity mainly a matter of coming to terms with that question? Or is it, rather more mundanely, a matter of properly calibrating levels of serotonin in the synapses? Or are these somehow, after all, the same thing? Perhaps man is one of the most fearful creatures, since added to the basic fears of predators and hostile conspecifics come intellectually based existential fears. Irenaeus Abel Ibisfeld, Fear, Defense, and Aggression in Animals and Man, Some Ethological Perspectives, 1990. Not long ago, I emailed Dr. W., who has specialized in treating anxiety for 40 years, to ask him to boil his definition of it down to a single sentence. Anxiety, he wrote, is apprehension about future suffering, the fearful anticipation of an unbearable catastrophe one is hopeless to prevent. For Dr. W., the defining signature of anxiety, and what makes it more than a pure animal instinct, is its orientation toward the future. In this, Dr. W.'s thinking is in line with that of many leading theorists of the emotions. For instance, Robert Plutchik, a physician and psychologist who was one of the 20th century's most influential scholars of the emotions, defined anxiety as the combination of anticipation and fear. And he points out that Darwin, for all his emphasis on the behavioral similarities between animals and humans, believed the same. If we expect to suffer, we are anxious, Darwin wrote in The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals. If we have no hope of relief, we despair. Animals have no abstract concept of the future. They also have no abstract concept of anxiety, no ability to worry about their fears. An animal may experience stress-induced difficulty in breathing or spasms of the heart, as Freud put it. But no animal can worry about that symptom or interpret it in any way. An animal cannot be a hypochondriac. Also, an animal cannot fear death. Rats and marine snails are not abstractly aware of the prospect of a car accident or a plane crash or a terrorist attack or nuclear annihilation, or of social rejection or diminishment of status or professional humiliation, or the inevitable loss of people we love, or the finitude of corporeal existence. This, along with our capacity to be consciously aware of the sensations of fear and to cogitate about them, gives the human experience of anxiety an existential dimension that the alarm response of a marine snail utterly lacks. For Dr. W., this existential dimension is crucial. Dr. W., echoing Freud, says that while fear is produced by real threats from the world, anxiety is produced by threats from within ourselves. Anxiety is, as Dr. W. puts it, a signal that the usual defenses against unbearably painful views of the self are failing. Rather than confronting the reality that your marriage is failing, or that your career has not panned out, or that you are declining into geriatric decrepitude, or that you are going to die, hard existential truths to reckon with, your mind sometimes instead produces distracting and defensive anxiety symptoms, transmuting psychic distress into panic attacks, or free-floating general anxiety, or developing phobias onto which you project your inner turmoil. Interestingly, a number of recent studies have found that at the moment an anxious patient begins to reckon consciously with a previously hidden psychic conflict, lifting it from the murk of the unconscious into the light of awareness, a slew of physiological measurements change markedly. Blood pressure and heart rate drop. Skin conductance decreases. Levels of stress hormones in the blood decline. Chronic physical symptoms, backaches, stomach aches, headaches, often dissipate spontaneously as emotional troubles that had previously been somaticized or converted into physical symptoms get brought into conscious awareness. Even as much of Freudianism has been substantially discredited, elements of Freud's theories have gained empirical support in the recent findings of research like this. But in believing that anxiety disorders typically arise from failed efforts to resolve basic existential dilemmas, Dr. W. is, as we will see, running against the grain of modern psychopharmacology, which proffers the evidence of 60 years of drug studies to argue that anxiety and depression are based on chemical imbalances. Neuroscience, whose emergence has demonstrated not only the brain activity associated with various emotional states, but also, in some cases, the specific structural abnormalities associated with mental illness, and temperament studies and molecular genetics, which suggest, rather convincingly, a powerful role for heredity in the determination of one's baseline level of anxiety and susceptibility to psychiatric illness. Dr. W. doesn't dispute the findings from any of those modes of inquiry. He believes medication can be an effective treatment for the symptoms of anxiety. But his view, based on 30 years of clinical work with hundreds of anxious patients, is that at the root of almost all clinical anxiety is some kind of existential crisis about what he calls the ontological givens. That we will grow old, that we will die, that we will lose people we love, that we will likely endure identity-shaking professional failures and personal humiliations, that we must struggle to find meaning and purpose in our lives, and that we must make trade-offs between personal freedom and emotional security and between our desires and the constraints of our relationships and our communities. In this view, our phobias of rats or snakes or cheese or honey, yes, honey, the actor Richard Burton could not bear to be in a room with honey, even if it was sealed in a jar, even if the jar was closed in a drawer, are displacements of our deeper existential concerns projected onto outward things. Early in his career, Dr. W. treated a college sophomore who had trained his entire life to become a professional concert pianist. When the patient's professors told him that he wasn't talented enough to realize his dream, he was beset by terrible panic attacks. In Dr. W.'s view, the panic was a symptom produced by the patient's inability to reckon with the underlying existential loss here, the end of his professional aspirations, the demise of his self-conception as a concert pianist. Treating the panic allowed the student to experience his despair at this loss and then begin to construct a new identity. Another patient, a 43-year-old physician with a thriving medical practice, developed panic disorder when, right around the time his older son went off to college, he began getting injuries playing tennis, a sport at which he had formerly excelled. The panic, Dr. W. concluded, was precipitated by these dual losses of his son's childhood, of his own athletic vigor, which in combination aroused existential concerns about decline into decrepitude and death. By helping the physician come to terms with these losses and to accept the ontological reality of his eventual decline and mortality, Dr. W. enabled him to shake free of the anxiety and depression. I should say here that I am not betraying any confidentiality in writing about these patients. Dr. W. has published anonymous case histories of them in various places. In Dr. W.'s view, anxiety and panic symptoms serve as what he calls a protective screen, what Freud called a neurotic defense, against the searing pain associated with confronting loss or mortality or threats to one's self-esteem. roughly what Freud called the ego. In some cases, the intense anxiety or panic symptoms patients experience are neurotic distractions from, or a way of coping with, negative self-images or feelings of inadequacy, what Dr. W. calls self-wounds. I find Dr. W.'s existential meaning-based interpretations of anxiety symptoms to be in some ways more interesting than the prevailing biomedical ones. But for a long time, I found the modern research literature on anxiety, which has much more to do with neuronal firing rates in the amygdala and locus coeruleus, as the neuroscientists put it, and with boosting the serotonergic system and inhibiting the glutamate system, as the psychopharmacologists put it, and with identifying the specific single nucleotide polymorphisms on various genes that predict an anxious temperament, as the behavioral geneticists put it, than with existential issues, to be more scientific and more convincing than Dr. W.'s theory of anxiety. I still do, but less so than I did before. Not long ago in my own therapy with Dr. W., we moved gingerly into imaginal exposure for my phobias. This therapy draws on a technique called systematic desensitization, which was pioneered in the 1960s by Joseph Volpe, an influential behavioral psychologist whose initial research was on how to eliminate fear responses in cats. Dr. W. and I established a hierarchy of frightening situations and then did a gentle, staged deconditioning, in which I was supposed to picture certain distressing images while doing deep breathing relaxation exercises, hoping to reduce the anxiety these images stimulated. Once I'd conjured an image and was trying to hold it in my mind without panicking, Dr. W. would ask me what I was feeling. This proved to be surprisingly hard. Although I was sitting safely in the consulting room of Dr. W.'s suburban home and was free to stop the exercise at any time, merely imagining frightening scenarios became an agony of anxiety. The smallest, most unlikely seeming cues, seeing myself riding on a chairlift or a turbulence-racked airplane, picturing the green bucket that would be placed by my bed when I had an upset stomach as a young boy, set me to sweating and hyperventilating. So intense was my anxious response to these purely mental images that several times I had to leave Dr. W.'s office to walk around in his backyard and calm down. In these deconditioning sessions, Dr. W. has tried to get me to focus on what, precisely, I'm anxious about. I have a hard time answering this question. During the imaginal exposure, let alone when I'm actually confronted with a phobic stimulus, I cannot focus at all on answering the question. I just feel complete, all-consuming dread, and all I want is to escape from terror, from consciousness, from my body, from my life. I once suggested to Dr. W. that if I had a gun and knew that I at least had the option of escaping phobic terror, then maybe my anxiety would subside, since having the option of escape would give me the feeling of some control. Perhaps, he conceded, but it would also increase the chances of you offing yourself. Over the course of several sessions, something unexpected happened. When I tried to engage with the phobia, I'd get derailed by sadness. I'd sit on the couch in Dr. W.'s office, doing deep breathing and trying to picture the scene from my deconditioning hierarchy, and my mind would start to wander. "Tell me what you're feeling," Dr. W. would say. "A little sad," I would say. "Go with that," he would say. And then seconds later, I'd be racked by sobs. I am embarrassed to recount this little tale. For one thing, how unmanly can I be? For another, I'm not a believer in the magical emotional breakthrough or the cathartic release, but I confess that I did feel some kind of relief as I sat there shuddering with sobs. This outburst of sadness occurred each time we tried the exercise. "What's going on?" I asked Dr. W. "What does this mean?" "It means we're on to something," he said, handing me a tissue to dry my tears. Yes, I know, everything about this scene makes me cringe too. But at the time, as I sobbed there on the couch, Dr. W's statement felt like a wonderfully supportive and authentic gesture, which touched me and made me cry even harder. "You're in the heart of the wound now," he said. Dr. W believes, as Freud did, that anxiety could be an adaptation meant to shield the psyche from some other source of sadness or pain. I ask him why, if that's the case, the anxiety often feels much more intense than the sadness. As hard as it's making me cry, this wound that I'm supposedly in feels less unpleasant than the terror I feel when I'm on a turbulent flight, or when I'm feeling nauseated, or when I was enduring separation anxiety as a child. That's often the case, Dr. W. says. I'm not sure what to make of this. Why do I feel so much better, happier and relatively less anxious after swimming around in my putative wound? In their early work developing psychoanalytic techniques together during the 1890s, Sigmund Freud and his mentor, Josef Breuer, called this cathartic dredging up of suppressed thoughts and emotions chimney sweeping. We don't know yet, Dr. W. says, but we're getting somewhere. Part 2. A History of My Nervous Stomach. Chapter 3. A Rumbling in the Belly. Anxiousness, a difficult disease. The patient thinks he has something like a thorn, something pricking him in his viscera, and nausea torments him. Hippocrates, On Diseases, 4th century B.C. I have this recurring nightmare of being ill as a bride, running out of the church and abandoning my husband at the altar. Emma Pelling, quoted in the June 5, 2008 United Press International article, Bride's Vomit Fear Delays Wedding. I struggle with emetophobia, a pathological fear of vomiting, but it's been a little while since I last vomited. More than a little while, actually. As I type this, it's been, to be precise, 35 years, 2 months, 4 days, 22 hours, and 49 minutes, meaning that more than 83% of my days on Earth have transpired in the time since I last threw up during the early evening of March 17, 1977. I didn't vomit in the 1980s. I didn't vomit in the 1990s. I haven't vomited in the new millennium. And needless to say, I hope to make it through the balance of my life without having that streak disrupted. Naturally, I was reluctant even to type this paragraph, and particularly that last sentence, for fear of jinxing myself or inviting cosmic rebuke, and I am knocking wood and offering up prayers to various gods and fates as I write this. What this means is that I have spent, by rough calculation, at least 60% of my waking life thinking about and worrying about something that I have spent 0% of the last 3-plus decades doing. This is irrational. A part of me protests instantly. But wait, what if it's not irrational? What if, in fact, there's a causal relationship between my worrying about vomiting and my not doing it? What if my eternal vigilance is what protects me, through magic or through neurotic enhancement of my immune system or through sheer obsessive germ avoidance from food poisoning and stomach viruses? When I've made this argument to various psychotherapists over the years, they respond, "Let's say you're right about the causal relation. Your behavior is still irrational. Look how much time you waste and what you've done to your quality of life worrying about something that, while unpleasant, is generally rare and almost always medically insignificant. Even if the cost of relaxing my vigilance was a stomach virus or bout of food poisoning every so often," the therapists say, "wouldn't that be worthwhile for what I'd gain in getting so much of my life back?" I suppose a rational, non-phobic person would answer yes, and they'd surely be right. But for me, the answer remains emphatically no. An astonishing portion of my life is built around trying to evade vomiting and preparing for the eventuality that I might. Some of my behavior is standard germophobic stuff, avoiding hospitals and public restrooms, giving wide berth to sick people, obsessively washing my hands, paying careful attention to the provenance of everything I eat. But other behavior is more extreme, given the statistical unlikelihood of my vomiting at any given moment. I stash motion sickness bags, purloined from airplanes, all over my home and office and car in case I'm suddenly overtaken by the need to vomit. I carry Pepto-Bismol and Dramamine and other antiemetic medications with me at all times. Like a general monitoring the enemy's advance, I keep a detailed mental map of recorded incidences of norovirus, the most common strain of stomach virus, and other forms of gastroenteritis, using the internet to track outbreaks in the United States and around the world. Such is the nature of my obsession that I can tell you at any given moment exactly which nursing homes in New Zealand, cruise ships in the Mediterranean, and elementary schools in Virginia are contending with outbreaks. Once, when I was lamenting to my father that there is no central clearinghouse for information about norovirus outbreaks the way there is for influenza, my wife interjected, "Yes, there is," she said. We looked at her quizzically. "You," she said. And she had a point. Emetophobia has governed my life with a fluctuating intensity of tyranny for some 35 years. Nothing. Not the thousands of psychotherapy appointments I've sat through, not the dozens of medications I've taken, not the hypnosis I underwent when I was 18, not the stomach viruses I've contracted and withstood without vomiting, has succeeded in stamping it out. For several years, I worked with a therapist named Dr. M., a young psychologist who had a practice at Boston University's Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders. I had originally sought treatment for my public speaking anxiety, but after several months of consultations, Dr. M. proposed that we also try applying the principles of what's known as exposure therapy toward extinguishing my emetophobia. Which is how I came to find myself not long ago at the center of an absurdist tableau. I'm giving a speech about the founding of the Peace Corps, which feels a little artificial and awkward to begin with, because the venue is a small conference room off a hallway in the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders. My audience consists of Dr. M. and three graduate students she's corralled at a moment's notice from around the building. Meanwhile, in the corner of the room, a large television is showing a video loop of a series of people throwing up. Originally, President Kennedy's plan was to house the Peace Corps inside the Agency for International Development, I'm saying, as a man on the screen to my right retches loudly. But Lyndon Johnson had been convinced by Kennedy's brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, that stuffing the Peace Corps inside an existing government bureaucracy would stifle its effectiveness and end up neutering it. On the screen, vomit spatters onto the floor. A device attached to my finger is monitoring my heart rate and levels of blood oxygen. Every few minutes, Dr. M. interrupts my speech to say, "Give me your anxiety rating now." I'm to respond by giving her an assessment of my anxiety at that moment on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being completely calm and 10 being unalloyed terror. "About a 6, I say truthfully. I'm less anxious than embarrassed and grossed out. "Go on," she says, and I resume my lecture as the cacophony of puking continues on the screen. When I glance up, I can see that the graduate students, two young women and a young man, are trying to pay attention to what I'm saying, but they're clearly distracted by all the literal upheaval in the background. The male student is looking green. His Adam's apple is twitching. I can tell he's fighting his gag reflex. I'm feeling a little anxious, yes, but also, frankly, ridiculous. How is giving a fake speech to a fake audience amid cascading images of vomiting going to cure me of my phobia of public speaking or of throwing up? As bizarre as this scene was, the therapeutic principles underlying it are well established. Exposure therapy, in essence, exposure to whatever's causing the pathological fear, whether that's rats or snakes or airplanes or heights or throwing up, has for dozens of years been a standard treatment for phobias, and it is now an important component of cognitive behavioral therapy. The logic of this approach, which has lately been undergirded by neuroscience research, is that extended exposure to the object of fear under the guidance of a therapist makes that object less frightening. Someone with fear of heights would, accompanied by a therapist, walk farther and farther out onto the balconies of higher and higher buildings. Someone with siderodramaphobia, train phobia, would take a short subway ride and then a longer one and then a still longer one until the fear diminished and was gradually extinguished completely. A more aggressive form of exposure, known as flooding, calls for a more intense experience. To treat, say, airplane phobia, using the standard exposure technique, a fearful flyer might be started off with visits to the airport to watch airplanes take off and land until his anxiety level comes down. He would progress to actually walking onto an airplane and getting acclimated to being on it, allowing the intensity of physical responses and fearful emotions to crest and fall, and then advance to taking a short commercial flight in the company of a therapist. Ultimately, he would graduate to taking longer flights alone. Applying flooding to aerophobia might entail, instead, starting the patient out on a tiny twin-engine plane, flying him up into the sky, and subjecting him to stomach-churning aeronautical gymnastics. According to the theory, the patient's anxiety will spike initially, but will then subside as he learns quickly that he can survive both the flying and the experience of his own anxiety. Some therapists maintain relationships with local pilots so they can offer this sort of therapy. Dr. M offered it to me. I declined. David Barlow, the former head of the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, says the goal of exposure therapy is to scare the hell out of the patient in order to teach him that he can handle the fear. Barlow's exposure techniques may sound cruel and unusual, but he claims a phobia cure rate of up to 85%, often within a week or less, and an ample number of studies support this claim. On the other hand, a lot of the evidence suggests that phobic anxiety is much more easily formed than extinguished. Barlow himself has a phobia of heights that he admits he has been unable to cure himself of. The idea behind Dr. M's notion of trying to combine my exposures to public speaking and to vomiting was to ratchet up my anxiety as high as possible, the better to expose me to it and to the things that I feared so that I could begin the process of extinguishing those fears. The problem was that these simulations were too artificial to generate the requisite level of anxiety in me. Speaking to a few graduate students in Dr. M's office made me nervous and uncomfortable, but it never generated anything like the all-consuming dread that a real public speaking engagement does, especially since I knew that the graduate students were all studying anxiety disorders. I didn't feel compelled, as I usually do, to try to hide my anxiety. I already assumed Dr. M's colleagues saw me as damaged, and therefore I didn't have to go to such anxiety-producing lengths to hide my damagedness. So although even small meetings at work could still throw me into an agony of panic, to say nothing of the large-scale public speaking engagements that I would dread for months in advance, the faux presentations I'd make in my weekly sessions with Dr. M felt like clammy facsimiles of the real thing. Awkward and unpleasant, yes, but not sufficiently anxiety-provoking to be effective exposure therapy. Similarly, while the experience of watching the vomit videos was discomforting and unpleasant, it produced nothing close to the level of limb-trembling, soul-shaking horror that feeling about to vomit does. I knew the videos couldn't infect me, and I knew I could always simply look away or turn them off if my anxiety became too much to bear. Crucially, and fatally, as far as effective exposure therapy went, escape was always possible. Incidentally, the very existence of these vomit videos, and I've now seen several, is evidence of how common emetophobia is. Using them has become common practice in treating phobics. Some therapists also try to gradually decondition their emetophobic patients by exposing them to fake vomit. In case you're interested, here's a recipe recommended by two Emory University psychologists I met at a conference in 2008. Mix one can of beef and barley soup with one can of cream of mushroom soup. Add small quantities of sweet relish and vinegar. Pour into a glass jar, seal, and leave on a windowsill for 1 week. Determining, as a number of other therapists, before and since also have, that my fear of vomiting lay at the core of my other fears, for instance, I'm afraid of airplanes, partly because I might get airsick, Dr. M proposed that we concentrate on that. "Makes sense to me," I concurred. "There's only one way to do that properly," she said. "You need to confront the phobia head on, to expose yourself to that which you fear the most." Uh-oh. "We have to make you throw up." "No. No way. Absolutely not." She explained that a colleague had just successfully treated an emetophobe by giving her Ipecac syrup, which induces vomiting. The patient, a female executive who had flown in from New York to be treated, had spent a week visiting the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders. Each day she'd take Ipecac administered by a nurse, vomit, and then process the experience with the therapist, decatastrophizing it, as the cognitive behavioral therapists say. After a week, she flew back to New York, cured, Dr. M reported, of her phobia. I remained skeptical. Dr. M gave me an academic journal article reporting on a clinical case of emetophobia successfully treated with the Ipecac exposure method. "This is just a single case," I said. "It's from 1979. "There have been lots of others," she said, and reminded me again of her colleague's patient. "I can't do it." "You don't have to do anything you don't want to do," Dr. M said. "I'll never force you to do anything. But the only way to overcome this phobia is to confront it, and the only way to confront it is to throw up." We had many versions of this conversation over the course of several months. I trusted Dr. M, despite the inane-seeming exposures she cooked up for me. She was kind and pretty and smart. So one autumn day I surprised her by saying I was open to thinking about the idea. Gently, reassuringly, she talked me through how the process would work. She and the staff nurse would reserve a lab upstairs for my privacy and would be with me the whole time. I'd eat something, take the Ipecac, and vomit in short order. And I would survive just fine, she said. Then we would work on reframing my cognitions about throwing up. I'd learn that it wasn't something to be terrified of, and I'd be liberated. She took me upstairs to meet the nurse. Nurse R showed me the lab and told me that taking Ipecac was a standard form of exposure therapy. She said she'd helped preside over a number of exposures for erstwhile emetophobes. "Just the other week we had a guy in here," she said. "He was very nervous, but it worked out just fine." We went back downstairs to Dr. M's office. "Okay," I said. "I'll do it. Maybe." Over the next few weeks, we'd keep scheduling the exposure, and then I'd show up on the appointed day and demur, saying I couldn't go through with it. I did this enough times that I shocked Dr. M when, on an unseasonably warm Thursday in early December, I presented myself at her office for my regular appointment and said, "Okay, I'm ready." The exercise was star-crossed from the beginning. Nurse R was out of Ipecac, so she had to run to the pharmacy to get some more while I waited for an hour in Dr. M's office. Then it turned out that the upstairs lab was booked, so the exposure would have to take place in a small public restroom in the basement. I was constantly on the verge of backing out. Probably the only reason I didn't was that I knew I could. What follows is an edited excerpt drawn from the dispassionate as possible account I wrote up afterward on Dr. M's recommendation. Writing an emotionally neutral account is a commonly prescribed way of trying to forestall post-traumatic stress disorder after a traumatic experience. If you're emetophobic yourself, or even just a little squeamish, you might want to skip over it. We met up with Nurse R in the basement restroom. After some discussion, I took the Ipecac. Having passed the point of no return, I felt my anxiety surge considerably. I began to shake a little. Still, I was hopeful that sickness would strike quickly and be over fast, and that I would discover the experience was not as bad as I'd feared. Dr. M had attached a pulse and oxygen level monitor to my finger. As we waited for the nausea to hit, she asked me to state my anxiety level on a scale of 1 to 10. "About a 9," I said. By now, I was starting to feel a little nauseated. Suddenly, I was struck by heaving, and I turned to the toilet. I retched twice, but nothing felt like it was coming up. I knelt on the floor and waited, still hoping the event would come quickly and then be over with. The monitor on my finger felt like an encumbrance, so I took it off. After a time, I heaved again, my diaphragm convulsing. Nurse R explained that dry heaving precedes the main event. I was now desperate for this to be over. The nausea began coming in intense waves, crashing over me and then receding. I kept feeling like I was going to vomit, but then I would heave noisily again and nothing would come up. Several times I could actually feel my stomach convulse, but I would heave and nothing would happen. My sense of time at this point gets blurry. During each bout of retching, I would begin perspiring profusely, and when the nausea would pass, I would be dripping with sweat. I felt faint, and I worried that I would pass out and vomit and aspirate and die. When I mentioned feeling lightheaded, Nurse R said that my color looked good, but I thought she and Dr. M seemed slightly alarmed. This increased my anxiety, because if they were worried, then I should really be scared, I thought. On the other hand, at some level I wanted to pass out, even if that meant dying. After about 40 minutes and several more bouts of retching, Dr. M and Nurse R suggested I take more Ipecac, but I feared a second dose would subject me to worse nausea for a longer period of time. I worried I might just keep dry heaving for hours or days. At some point, I switched from hoping that I would vomit quickly and have the ordeal over with to thinking that maybe I could fight the Ipecac and simply wait for the nausea to wear off. I was exhausted, horribly nauseated, and utterly miserable. In between bouts of retching, I lay on the bathroom tiles, shaking. A long period passed. Nurse R and Dr. M kept trying to convince me to take more Ipecac, but by now I just wanted to avoid vomiting. I hadn't retched for a while, so I was surprised to be stricken by another bout of violent heaving. I could feel my stomach turning over, and I thought for sure that this time something would happen. It didn't. I choked down some secondary waves, and then the nausea eased significantly. This was the point when I began to feel hopeful that I would manage to escape the ordeal without throwing up. Nurse R seemed angry. "Man, you have more control than anyone I've ever seen," she said. At one point, she asked peevishly if I was resisting because I wasn't prepared to terminate treatment yet. Dr. M interjected that this was clearly not the case. I'd taken the Ipecac, for God's sake. Eventually, several hours had now elapsed since I ingested the Ipecac. Nurse R left, saying she had never seen someone take Ipecac and not vomit. I've since read that up to 15% of people, a disproportionate number of them emetophobes, don't vomit from a single dose of Ipecac. After some more time passed, and some more encouragement from Dr. M to try to complete the exposure, we decided to end the attempt. I still felt nauseated, but less so than before. We talked briefly in her office, and then I left. Driving home, I became extremely anxious that I would vomit and crash. I waited at red lights in terror. When I got home, I crawled into bed and slept for several hours. I felt better when I woke up. The nausea was gone. But that night, I had recurring nightmares of retching in the bathroom in the basement of the center. The next morning, I managed to get to work for a meeting. But then panic surged and I had to go home. For the next several days, I was too anxious to leave the house. Dr. M called the next day to make sure I was okay. She clearly felt bad about having subjected me to such a miserable experience. Though I was traumatized by the whole episode, her sense of guilt was so palpable that I felt sympathetic toward her. At the end of the account I composed at her request, which was accurate as far as it went, I masked the emotional reality of what I thought, which was that the exposure had been an abject disaster and that Nurse R was a fatuous bitch, with an antiseptic clinical tone. Given my history, I was brave to take the Ipecac, I wrote. I wish that I had vomited quickly, but the whole experience was traumatic, and my general anxiety levels, and my phobia of vomiting, are more intense than they were before the exposure. I also, however, recognize that, based on this experience in resisting the effects of the Ipecac, my power to prevent myself from vomiting is quite strong. Stronger, it seems, than Dr. M's. She told me she had to cancel all of her afternoon appointments on the day of the exposure. Watching me gagging and fighting with the Ipecac evidently had made her so nauseated that she spent the afternoon at home, throwing up. I confess I took some perverse pleasure from the irony here. The Ipecac I took made someone else vomit. But mainly I felt traumatized and intensely anxious. It seems I'm not very good at getting over my phobias, but quite good at making my therapists and their associates sick. I continued seeing Dr. M for a few more months. We processed the botched exposure, and then, both of us wanting to forget the whole thing, turned from emetophobia to various other phobias and neuroses. The sessions now had an elegiac, desultory feel. We both knew it was over. Eventually, she moved away, accepting a tenure-track faculty position at a university in the Southwest. I run into her occasionally at academic conferences on anxiety. Despite everything, I like her. But I always wonder, does it feel weird to her to be talking to a former patient who's now at these conferences with a notebook, posing as a journalist and a kind of lay expert on anxiety? How often does she think, that's the guy I gave Ipecac to, the guy I watched retching and weeping and shaking on the floor of a public restroom for hours? That sphincter, which serves to discharge our stomachs, has dilations and contractions proper to itself, independent of our wishes and even opposed to them. Michel de Montaigne, On the Power of the Imagination, 1574. The mind, as the neurophilosophers say, is fully embodied. It is, as Aristotle put it, enmattered. The bodily clichés of nervous excitement, butterflies in the stomach, anxious anticipation, a loosening of the bowels, scared shitless, or dread, felt in the pit of the stomach, are not in fact clichés or even metaphors, but truisms, accurate descriptions of the physiological correlates of anxious emotion. Doctors and philosophers have observed for millennia the potency of what the medical journals call the brain-gut axis. There may even be some connection between a phobia and a beefsteak, So intimately related are the stomach and the brain, Wilfred Northfield wrote in 1934. Nerve-disordered bellies are a bane of modern existence. According to a Harvard Medical School report, as many as 12% of all patient visits to primary care physicians in the United States are for irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, a condition characterized by stomach pain and alternating bouts of constipation and diarrhea that most experts believe to be wholly or partly caused by stress or anxiety. First identified in 1830 by the British physician John Howship, IBS has since then been referred to as spastic colon, spastic bowel, colitis, and functional bowel disease, among other names. Physicians in the Middle Ages and Renaissance referred to it as windy melancholy and hypochondriac flatulence. Because no one has ever definitively identified an organic cause of IBS, most doctors attribute its appearance to stress, emotional conflict, or some other psychological source. In the absence of a clear malfunction in the nerves and muscles of the gut, doctors tend to assume a malfunction in the brain, perhaps a hypersensitized awareness of sensations in the intestine. In one well-known set of experiments, when balloons were inflated in the colons of both IBS patients and healthy control subjects, the IBS patients reported a much lower threshold for pain, suggesting that the viscera-brain connection may be more sensitive in patients with irritable bowels. This is consistent with a trait called anxiety sensitivity, which research has shown to be strongly correlated with panic disorder. Individuals who rate high on the so-called Anxiety Sensitivity Index, or ASI, have a high degree of what's known as interoceptive awareness, meaning they are highly attuned to the inner workings of their bodies, to the beepings and bleedings, the blips and burps of their physiologies. They are more conscious of their heart rate, blood pressure, body temperature, breathing rates, digestive burblings, and so forth than other people are. This hyper-awareness of physiological activity makes such people more prone to internally cued panic attacks. The individual with a high